You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, Wisconsin is home to one of the nation's top log rolling competitors, a 17-year-old young woman from Holman. We'll talk to her about her love of the sport and the keys to her success. Right now, the Trump administration's first deadline to reunite migrant families separated at the border was yesterday. And for some families, the process was chaotic and confusing. Others are still waiting. To date, government officials have only reunited a small fraction of the thousands of children separated from their parents, a practice that stemmed from the administration's widely criticized zero-tolerance policy. Katie Benner is a reporter covering the Justice Department for the New York Times. Katie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So which families did yesterday's court-imposed deadline apply to specifically?
So the deadline applied yesterday to reunifying children ages 5 and under with their families, and that amounted to about 102 toddlers.
And a small portion within that group of families with the 5 and under children were not subject to yesterday's deadline because their cases are more complicated. What are the different factors applying to those families?
Right, absolutely. So, you know, the government said that it was only able to identify, locate, and vet the parents of just 54 of the 102 kids, and about a third were reunited yesterday. You know, the government's saying that they needed to really inspect the adults and make sure that they were indeed the parents of these children, that they weren't facing a human trafficking situation and putting children in danger. They were doing DNA testing, and they were also looking at criminal records of some of the adults. Now, the judge has said that he's largely satisfied with the government's progress, but he still urged them to move more quickly and said, you know, listen, is it really necessary that this level of vetting is what we need here?
Well, and I guess I'm wondering about the nuts and bolts of that. How is the government attempting to prove that a child belongs with the adult that they came to the border with? What kind of documentation are they looking for?
So they're looking for birth certificates, birth records. They're also doing DNA testing. And then finally, they're doing criminal background checks to make sure that they're not placing children in the hands of adults who have criminal records. So, for example, there are adults who have been proven to be relatives of some of the children, but at the same time, the government has decided that because these adults have some sort of criminal record, whether it's an assault or a rape, they don't want to put the children back together with the adults.
Well, and I'm guessing that they are doing criminal background checks for any time that adult may have spent in the United States before, but I'm guessing that the bulk of those would be in the countries that the people originated from. How do you do a background check on someone who's from another country, say Honduras or El Salvador?
Sure. I mean, that's not impossible. Governments do speak with one another all the time about criminal cases. But I do want to also point out that it is interesting. This is an extraordinarily high bar, and we have to remember that there are children in the United States every day who live with parents who have criminal records.
And so about half of the children under 5 have been reunited, missing the deadline for having them all reunited by yesterday. There's another deadline coming up for all the other children. Is the government working on two paths there, also working to start reuniting those older children?
Absolutely. On a call yesterday with government officials, the officials did say they are working to meet that deadline. They declined to say what the status was or to give any sort of guidance about whether or not they would meet it. That deadline's on July 26th. It accounts for all of the remaining children. That's a few thousand, and so we'll see if they're able to make that deadline. It doesn't seem likely.
Katie, do we know, I mean, we've seen some figures, I think at one point it was 2,300 children that had been separated, somewhere in the 2,000 range, but I'm guessing that a lot of those children are actually siblings, and so the number of families should be fewer, correct?
Absolutely. The number of families will be fewer. And keep in mind that children do come into the United States unaccompanied. That's not an unusual situation whatsoever. And so what we're dealing with right now are the children who've been separated from their parents, in large part because of the zero-tolerance policy. This does not account for the many, many children who cross the southwest border with no adult accompaniment every day.
Katie Benner covers the Justice Department for the New York Times. She's with us to talk about yesterday's deadline for reunification of families with children under 5 and the upcoming deadline for reuniting all the rest of the children with their families from whom they've been separated. Katie, what's it like when these families, these parents and children, are reunited for the first time in weeks or maybe even months?
So we've seen a really mixed bag of reunification stories. It's incredibly emotional no matter what happens, but you can tell that there are big differences in some of the reunification stories, and they depend on the age of the child. They depend on how much information the child was given before they were separated from their parents. So, for example, yesterday we found parents who, when they were finally paired with their children who were so young, who'd been separated from them for weeks, could no longer remember their parents, which was extraordinarily heartbreaking. We saw some children who had been separated from their parents, but Border Patrol officials had kindly tipped off the parents to what was going to happen, and the parents were able to talk to their children and explain, you know, mommy and daddy will be gone for a little bit, don't be afraid, I'll be back. And some of those children seemed to be faring a little better. And then there were some children who weren't given that kind of warning, who were separated for reasons they could not understand and haven't, you know, are having what looks to be extreme stress disorder.
Some of these children had been moved even as far as the other side of the country to different detention centers. What are the logistics of, say, getting a child who was being held in New York back to parents who might be in Texas?
Well, this is one of the very tricky things, one of the interesting things that I think really highlights how poorly thought out the entire zero tolerance policy and separation of families was by the Trump administration. So I spoke with a former attorney at the Justice Department who had overseen the Office of Immigration Litigation. And one of the interesting things that he pointed out to me was the fact that minors come into the United States unaccompanied often. And what they're doing, it's almost a one-way, imagine a one-way conveyor belt where the children come into the country, they do not have parents, and they're coming in because they're escaping something terrible back home. More importantly, they're coming in because there's somebody in the United States who can take custody of them. So their stop in government custody through HHS is just a way station while the government identifies the adult in the United States where they can continue to go. Now, what we see here is we're trying to make a one-way conveyor belt into a two-way conveyor belt. We're seeing the families come in. The government, through its prosecution policy, separates the children out, forcing them to become essentially unaccompanied, put into the care of the government on what is a conveyor belt that usually then just moves them into the interior of the country, but now has to somehow move them back to the country they came from, hopefully with their parents. This is not something that we've done before en masse. And so you're seeing a real logistical nightmare.
The Trump administration announced yesterday that it would release migrants with ankle bracelet monitors. Has this been done before with families that arrive at the border?
Right. So we have to remember that almost every single administration, going as far back as at least Bill Clinton, definitely Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, all struggled to deal with what to do about families coming across the border with young children. We have seen an uptick in all sorts of violence, political situations, and other situations happening in, in Central America that have really, seasonally increased the number of migrants coming over the border, over the southwest border. Even as other immigration numbers in total are going down, that number has fluctuated and remained quite high. Many administrations have said to themselves, how do we deter illegal entry at the southwest border? They've struggled with the same thing. And also many administrations have found that the only way they can handle the situation and follow all of the laws and court orders that are currently out there is to let families and their children come into the country wearing an ankle monitor so we can track their movements with a promise that they will come back for a court hearing. So this is not new, but it is a policy that the president has reviled. He's criticized. He has made made a point at many, many, many of his speeches on immigration. He has said that it's a horrible practice, and yet even this administration has found that they are left with very few choices and have to act as other administrations have.
And so very briefly, Katie, as we wrap up, so those families are together and then the decision will be made whether they can stay or they'll be deported?
Absolutely.
Well, Katie, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll check in with you as other deadlines approach.
Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
You too. That was Katie Benner, Justice Department reporter for the New York Times. She gave us an update on the Trump administration's progress on reuniting migrant families who were separated at the border. The deadline to reunite children 5 and under with their parents was yesterday. The Trump administration was not able to meet that deadline. Wisconsin has produced a lot of great athletes over the years, and a 17-year-old student at Holman High School near La Crosse is adding her name to that list. Livy Papadopoulos has been log rolling since she was in elementary school and recently made the jump from amateur to the professional level. She's the reigning champion at the Midwest Log Rolling Championships and the United States Open. She's with us from our studios in La Crosse. Livy, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So for those of us who aren't familiar with log rolling as a sport, can you give us a sense of what the competition involves? How does it work?
So log rolling is a competition of two athletes on a log trying to knock each other off without touching each other or crossing a line that's painted in the middle of the log. It's best of five matchups, and it's a double elimination tournament, so each match leads on to the finals.
So tell us about the log. Is this an actual wooden log, or are they synthetically made?
Yeah, so they're wood logs, Western Red Cedar, lathe turned.
All right, and so how long and how thick is this log that you're trying to stay on top of? Because you're trying to knock the other person off, but you're also trying to stay on yourself.
Exactly. So the logs are about 12 feet long, 12 to 13 feet, and you start on a big log at the beginning of the competition, and if you and your opponent both stay on for a certain amount of time, then you head to a smaller log, and if that goes a little bit long too, then you head on to the final log, which is the smallest and spins the fastest.
Wow. So are you barefoot or are you wearing some kind of shoes?
We wear spiked cleats, which dig into the log and keep for good traction.
And so my question when we first started talking about getting you on the show to talk about your sport is, how do you start? Because I imagine getting on a log the first time, you fall off right away whether anyone's trying to knock you off or not.
I was not talented in my first log rolling class, not at all. I started log rolling just like any kid picks up any sport. I saw it and I loved it right away. So
how do you learn to stay on the log? What are kind of the first steps? You know, I think when we start swimming, you know, there's like first
right.
You learn how to float and you learn how to tread water a little. Then you learn some basic strokes. What about log rolling? How do you get started?
So I actually do coach log rolling at a couple different programs around the La Crosse, Wisconsin area. But for beginners, it's the same thing every time. It's actually really not too much about the balance. It's about teaching your feet how to be able to control the log underneath you and to be able to keep yourself up and keep up with the log when it starts going fast.
It almost seems similar in some ways to learning how to walk on a tightrope.
You're
really learning how to connect with that little bit of material that's keeping you from falling.
For sure, yeah. It's really not too much about the balance, like I said, but that's definitely plays into it. It's, of course, a lot about the footwork getting started.
So you might not have been great when you first started, but you've certainly been on quite a roll, pun intended, in the log rolling world lately. Can you tell us about some of your recent victories you've had?
So as an amateur log roller between the ages of 12 and 16, I won 5 amateur world championship titles, and I was planning on going for my 6th this year, but I learned that I was qualified this year to compete professionally, so I decided to take the jump this year. I've competed so far in 3 different tournaments. I won all 3. I started out this summer at the Midwest Championships in Madison, Wisconsin, which was a pretty deep field. I won that. And then I also won the U.S. Open, which was held in Michigan this past July.
And how old are you right now, Livy?
I just turned 17.
Wow. So you are really, I mean, you're at the top of your sport.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I'm really looking forward to competing again. Honestly, sometimes I feel like I'm just getting lucky. I work really, really hard at what I do. I work at my craft. I keep myself in shape. I take nutrition into account, but at the same time, the people that I'm competing against are incredible athletes. They're so toned and they're so fit, and the way that they can move themselves on the log is incredible, and it's so great to be able to keep up with these people.
Well, as you said, I mean, any athlete, especially an athlete at the level that you are already at such an amazing young age, I mean, you really should be very proud of yourself. It is a lot of hard work, and it's a sacrifice, I'm sure, in other parts of your life to devote the time and energy that you need to this. What is it about log rolling that you love so much that you're happy to make it such a centerpiece of your life?
I really just love to do it. It kind of goes back to when I first started. I couldn't wait to go to log rolling class once a week, you know, and I still love it exactly the same way. Of course, I love pushing myself and working hard throughout the summer, but some of my favorite parts of log rolling is when we get to the end of the summer and the tournaments are over, and I just get to go mess around and have fun on the logs at the end of the year.
Just do it without having to worry about, you know,
Absolutely.
What it's doing to your rankings.
Yes.
So we've talked a little bit about the physical aspect of it, and that balance is important, but it's really, you know, learning to relate to the log and kind of be one with the
yeah.
log. What about, you know, is there any kind of mental aspect in dealing with the opponent that's on the other end of that log? Is there any kind of, you know, psyching each other out?
Stylistically, every log roller is a lot different. There are people that are smaller but really fit and tend to have marathon-type matches. They go for a really long time with each other, try to outlast the other person. There are other people that are really, really strong, and they're able to kick the other person off, of course, without touching them. They kick the log, and they spin it as fast as they can and really, really sprint and use that power that they have. Personally, I don't know if I would fit quite into either category. I think I'm a little bit unique when it comes to my style of log rolling. I definitely use my strength to my advantage. I do a lot of lifting to prepare, but I also sometimes try to wait it out a little bit and see what I can do to take advantage of the other person.
We talk about like core strength and balance, especially
yeah.
for older people, you know, prevent falls. It seems like you'd be using a lot of core strength when you're on that log.
Core is actually a big key in log rolling. You really want to have a strong core because you're pulling yourself back up, back and forth, you know. And when you're switching directions, then your core is your main spot in your body that you want to keep tight and focused in.
Is this a sport that's popular in other countries? Where are kind of the hot spots for log rolling?
Right now, a lot of the best pro athletes actually do come from the Midwest. However, there are people all over the country that compete and all over the world as well. There are new programs starting all over the world right now. There's a company called Key Log Rolling that's starting programs in different countries that didn't have access to the types of wood logs that we use. So they use synthetic logs, and right now it's really, really growing at a fast rate.
So, Livy, you're in high school now.
Yes.
You have gone pro in log rolling. How do you see your future and your future log rolling coming together?
I plan on log rolling as long as I possibly can. Usually people leave their prime in their late 30s, early 40s, but I want to see if I can make it that far, if not farther. And, of course, even when I'm done log rolling competitively, I want to keep log rolling for fun and keep teaching it for the rest of my life.
Wow, so you see at least 20 more years of competition.
That's my hope.
Wow. Well, we'll be watching you. Well, Livy, as we start to wrap up, you're making waves, again, pun intended, at a very young age. For those of us listening who might be a few or a lot of years older than you, is this a young person's sport, or should anyone give it a try just for fun?
Everyone should give it a try just for fun. They have classes all over the place in Wisconsin right now that have adult classes and beginner classes for kids. I'd love to see more people try it out around the area.
Well, Livy, thanks. That was Livy Papadopoulos. She is a champion log roller. This is Central Time. All this week, we've been talking about various facets of immigration history and policies in the United States. Today, we wanted to take a look at refugee resettlement and why people fleeing violence and political persecution look to the U.S. for hope. Between October 2016 and September 2017, the United States took in nearly 54,000 refugees, according to the United Nations Human Rights Council. Nearly 40% of those admitted to the U.S. came from the Near East and South Asia. And in 2017, Wisconsin welcomed 585 refugees. The number of refugees being admitted into the United States on the whole is on the decline, and a lot of factors play into which refugees are resettled in the U.S. Our next guest is here to talk about why we're seeing a drop in refugees being allowed to come into the U.S. and how the United States has responded to those seeking asylum over the years. Elise Cohn is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Judith. Glad to be with you.
Well, I'm so glad you're with us because there are so many different issues here, and one of the issues is the basic terms. What are we talking about when we talk about someone who is a refugee?
That is a great question to get the conversation started. There are several requirements, things that kind of distinguish a refugee from other types of migrants that you've been talking about on your series this week. So first of all, the refugee needs to be forcibly displaced as opposed to a voluntary migrant who may be seeking better economic opportunities, family reunification, education opportunities. Those would not meet the criteria for being considered a refugee. Second, we have this very strict legal definition that U.S. law follows, and we also have in international treaties, that the refugee must be fleeing due to a well-founded fear of persecution. So this can be based on their race, religion, nationality, their political opinion, or even something like their social group within the society. But if it's something like a natural disaster, for example, that would not meet that criteria, and they would need to seek some other kind of humanitarian relief. And then the final thing is they need to be outside the borders of their home territory. So unlike internally displaced people that may still be in the country, to be a refugee, they must have crossed some internationally recognized sovereign border.
And who determines whether an individual or a group of people have met the criteria of being, you know, forcibly removed? Who decides that?
Oh, yeah. And another really key point of all of this is the United Nations, the refugee agency, the UNHCR, they are the ones that will officially register refugees. For the case of the United States, we actually only tend to accept refugees who have already been registered officially with the UNHCR, and the UNHCR has sort of determined they do indeed meet those criteria. Of course, then for our country, we put them through a whole separate screening and vetting process for our own interview processes and security concerns.
Now, another term that we hear is asylum seeker. And how do people who are considered asylum seekers compare to people who are considered refugees?
Oh, yeah, another really good angle here. Asylum seekers are pursuing refugee status, but they have not yet been officially granted that status. In the U.S., we also have this interesting phenomenon where we call people that are already on our territory asking to be considered refugees and sort of pursuing asylum claims. We call them asylees, and we only call people refugees who we are receiving from other countries overseas that have already been registered with the UNHCR.
Well, now that we've got some of the basic terminology down, Elise, how welcoming has the United States been historically towards refugees?
Yeah, so we have this really fascinating foreign policy where our refugee inflows have been shaped a lot by our communist, sort of anti-communist Cold War era. So for a long time, we were very welcoming to, for example, Hungarians and Cubans fleeing communism. We used it as part of our kind of political propaganda that those people were voting against communism with their feet by choosing to leave and wanting to come to the U.S. for refuge. In the 1970s and 80s, we took in a lot of people from Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos as refugees, acknowledging our own culpability in the Indochina, as it was called then, or, you know, Vietnam War situation. So this is something where over time, a lot of it has been shaped by our political interests and our involvement overseas. But certainly in terms of raw numbers, we have taken in the greatest share over the years in the number of refugees. Per capita, not as much as some other countries that have done a bit more in terms of their smaller populations. But when you just look at the raw numbers, we have been very welcoming.
And according to the United Nations Human Rights Council, the U.S. has admitted about 3 million refugees since 1975.
Yeah, so again, when you look at those raw numbers and we look at our foreign policy interests of why we accepted those different groups, you can say that we've seen maybe something like an average of 70 to 80,000 refugees per year coming into the U.S. So for a long time, that was sort of the normal, quote, normal, if you can say that, in terms of our ceiling that we established for how many refugees we would admit every year.
We're talking with Elise Cohen. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Sheboygan and at UW-Manitowoc. And we're looking specifically as part of our series on immigration this week, we're looking at refugees and asylum status in the United States, trends and policies. And Elise, I was interested to find out that that refugees don't necessarily seek refugee status or resettlement in a particular country. They aren't able to choose. Is that correct?
Right. So one of the things that happens once the refugee is sort of qualified by the UNHCR and registered with the UNHCR, a very limited number of them will be considered for what's called third country resettlement. It's something like, on average, less than 1% of the world's refugees. And right now, we're talking about 25 million refugees. We're kind of at a record high of global displacement, and that includes refugees. So less than 1% of those will actually be resettled in a third country. A lot of them will end up being locally integrated in whichever country they initially fled to, or unfortunately, the case is increasingly common where they will languish in what's supposed to be temporary refugee camps, but they may end up being there, you know, upwards of 15, 20, 25 years.
Is it a requirement of member states of the United Nations to accept refugees, or how do countries become countries that do accept them?
Oh, this is probably the key debate and issue for those that work on refugee issues, is we do not have any clear mechanisms of how the responsibility to protect refugees should be allocated. So there's this very sort of vague language in our refugee convention and other international laws and norms that, you know, all countries in the spirit of cooperation should be contributing. We have seen proposals for quotas in the past, but they inevitably failed, and countries did not want to commit to taking a certain number. So what we've seen is kind of like an ad hoc basis based on the political interests or maybe the domestic politics in those countries at the time. Each country sort of responds to each refugee crisis in its own distinct way.
But it sounds like if a country, the U.S. or another country, decided that they no longer were open to accepting refugees, they could make that decision.
Yes, you're absolutely right. We do have some international legal requirements from the Refugee Convention, and the United States is a party to that, so we're bound by that. We can't send someone away back to a territory where they would face harm, persecution, or torture. It's called the prohibition on non-refoulement, which means returning. So the prohibition of returning someone back to that territory. And we have sort of circumvented that sometimes. There are those legal scholars that say that also means we should not be frustrating the attempt for people to seek asylum. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that is a basic fundamental human right, is people should be able to leave the territory where they are being harmed and get refuge somewhere else. But you're picking up on the sort of paradox or the tension where there's no positive obligation that countries must take into their territory a certain number of refugees. And that's where we see the responsibility sharing sort of collapsing. For example, right now, a lot of people have looked, and a lot of countries have looked to the U.S. as a leader in the refugee responsibility sharing. And now that we've sort of departed from that and are moving away from that, it makes it easier for other countries to follow suit.
As we've said, refugees are in a very different situation than other types of immigrants. What support and systems are in place if they are resettled in the United States?
Oh, yeah, that's another really great question. We have a lot of bureaucracy built around this. So first of all, the president is supposed to consult with Congress every year to come up with what our annual cap will be for the following fiscal year. There was a little bit of controversy in the fall, as some people listening may remember, because the Trump administration didn't really consult with Congress. It just sort of came up with the lowered cap for fiscal year 2018 and then informed Congress, you know, this is what we're doing. But the way it's supposed to work is the legislative branch is consulted, and then all of these agencies in the State Department, Health and Human Services, Department of Homeland Security, really work together. And these agencies are crucial in the kinds of services that you're talking about: English language training, employment support. Of course, before they are even allowed in the country, they go through a very heavy security vetting process that usually takes about 2 years. Now it seems like it will be taking even much longer because of the new vetting requirements, of course, and medical screenings, cultural orientations. So after they've gone through all of that and they've arrived, that's when the local NGOs, a lot of faith-based community organizations, for example, are really crucial partners in helping them get settled in local communities around the country.
I believe the cap that was set for fiscal year 2016 was $85,000. How much was that cap lowered for fiscal year 2018?
Yeah, so that's where we saw some controversy and some debates kind of blossoming in our own domestic politics about refugee responsibility sharing. It was lowered to $45,000 for fiscal year 2018. The people looking at the numbers, though, because of the travel ban's lingering effects and because of the new enhanced vetting for a list of, like, you know, 10 or 11 countries, they're saying it's really more like we're going to end up somewhere around $20,000-$25,000. So we haven't been that low since the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when we kind of overhauled everything, created a whole new Department of Homeland Security. Even then, though, our cap was not lowered officially. Our cap was still at about $70,000. So we haven't had a cap this low since the invention of our refugee resettlement program in 1980.
We're talking right now with Elise Cohen. She's an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. She's with us to talk about refugee resettlement in the United States and the limits put on those coming to the U.S. seeking either refugee status or asylum. And we're taking your questions now at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about refugee resettlement in the United States or Wisconsin? What's confusing about the process? How do you think the United States handles refugees and similar issues? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're continuing our conversation about refugees in the United States as part of our series this week, Exploring Immigration. Our guest is Elise Cohen. She's an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc, and much of her research explores policies regulating refugees in the U.S. And you can call in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we should be accepting more or fewer refugees? And if you're a refugee who now lives in the United States, we'd like to hear your story. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Elise, we have Scott in Luxembourg, Wisconsin on the line. Let's go there. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I was talking with some friends this weekend about refugee resettlement, and one of them had commented that they didn't want to pay for the refugee resettlement, which made me wonder, how much does it cost the individual American taxpayer for our refugee resettlement program?
That's a great question, Scott. So, Elise, what kind of costs are involved, first of all, in resettlement of a refugee, and where does that money come from?
Yeah, that's a really great question. A lot of people ask that, and it ends up being very prominent in the debate over how many and is there sort of too much in terms of the strain it may put on our economy. First thing to think about for refugee resettlement is, across all these different agencies, that is going to come from the annual budget appropriations. But then for the Department of Homeland Security and all of that vetting and screening, that actually is funded through the fees that the Immigration and Citizenship Office already has people paying for their application. So some of that ends up funding itself. The other thing to keep in mind that sort of shocks people with our refugee policy is they are responsible for paying even their own airfare, any sort of travel costs accrued with coming here. There's actually a whole sort of refugee debt program where they repay debt because they take out loans, and a lot of that funding, just from the interest on the debt, goes directly back into the refugee resettlement, so they end up making some money to fund themselves just off of the loans they give refugees that they then must pay back. All of the studies that we have in terms of the economic impact, it ends up being, you know, how you measure it. And once you take it over 5 years, that's when you see the cost that your caller is talking about, the sort of social services expenditures, they start to diminish. Some of the studies that we have that go even broader, like maybe 15, 20 years down the road, they find the net impact tends to be contributing more to the economy. So a lot of refugees are entrepreneurial, may start businesses, create jobs in their local communities. Of course, refugees, like all other categories of legal immigrants, are paying taxes, so they end up contributing to the tax revenue base. So again, there's no perfect and magic answer because there's a lot of different indicators you can look at for the economy. But what we can say sort of across all of these studies is once you go over 5 years, we tend to see that it's a net positive contribution into the host country's economy.
Scott, thanks for that call. And Elise, one of the issues that you study that really comes into this discussion is nativism. Can you briefly explain that concept for us?
Oh, yeah. That's one that I've been looking at a lot in my research, my current book project as well. So first of all, just to define it, because I'm not sure how many listeners have heard of the term, nativism is sort of a defensive nationalism. So we're thinking about viewing foreigners as threatening, somehow possibly a threat or danger to the American way of life. So we've seen this, you know, from the very beginning of our country's sovereignty, that we always had the sort of tendency to view foreigners with a fear, maybe even hostility. And it has heavily shaped our immigration policy. And I think some of your other programs this week have, you know, talked about the Asian exclusionary policies and Japanese internment. What I'm looking at with the Syrian refugee crisis, it's really interesting where we see an overlap of when the Syrian refugee crisis got politicized. You know, think back to a little bit before the 2016 elections, especially in 2015, we saw the Syrian refugee crisis became incredibly politicized in our own domestic politics. And around that time that we see this very anti-Syrian refugee, sort of anti-immigrant language, nativist language, start to be prominent again in our political discussion, the FBI finds a rise in hate crimes against people that are perceived to be Muslim. Listeners may remember a couple of sort of famous stories of what I would actually call nativist violence from last year. There was a violent physical attack in Oregon. A man working in a Middle Eastern restaurant was beaten with a pipe while being called a terrorist and told to, quote, get out of America. And around the same time in March of last year, a Florida man set fire to a convenience store that he mistakenly believed was Muslim-owned. And he said the reason he did that is he wanted to, quote, do his part to run the Arabs out of our country. So what I found in my research is there is clearly a relationship between how our policymakers and members of the public are thinking about refugee policy and a sort of persistent nativism that we have within our own society, where Muslims and Middle Easterners are viewed as, you know, foreigners who don't really belong and they're not real Americans.
But what's interesting to me, Elise, is that this is a time where the numbers are dropping pretty rapidly of how many people are being admitted to the U.S., but the rhetoric isn't necessarily going down along with it. It sounds like actually the rhetoric is ramping up.
Oh, yeah, that's a great observation. So, you know, what we find in political science research is we have these things called partisan cues, where people will take messages from leaders in their political party, right? So if we think about maybe, you know, some officials in the Trump administration who are Republican and some Americans who identify strongly as, you know, Republicans, and they hear those messages surrounding, well, we're going to cut the cap to the lowest it's ever been, and here's why that's a good thing. They take those cues from those leaders in their party, and they start thinking about and talking about refugee responsibility sharing in a way that sort of fits with what they're hearing, those messages that, well, you know, refugees are, maybe they're a drag on the economy, or maybe we need to put our own people always first and not take any of these refugees, or maybe they're terrorists or criminals. And so that's a really fascinating thing when we start to look at what's being said. As you pointed out, it ends up being very prominent, even as the numbers are dropping, to kind of justify, and that's why we're doing the right thing by drastically cutting back on our refugee admissions.
Well, Elise, thank you so much to get through, and you really helped to clarify a lot of pretty confusing issues. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Elise Cohn is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. She joined us today to talk about the experience of refugees and asylum seekers in the United States as part of our series this week, Looking at Immigration in America. You can listen to past interviews in our immigration series online at WPR.org/Central Time. And tomorrow, we'll talk to an immigration attorney about the challenges facing unaccompanied immigrant children in the U.S. legal system.